Welcome back to the Athenaeum Review. I'm here with Stephen Asma, and we've been talking about the evolution of imagination. I wanted to talk now about your new book, Why We Need Religion. The publisher's description reads, "Unlike secular authors who praise religion's ethical and civilizing function, Asma argues that its core value lies in its emotionally therapeutic power. Why We Need Religion is about the way religion successfully manages human emotions for the good of the individual and the group."
Yeah, my own view is I'm not particularly religious. I consider myself basically an agnostic, but I also appreciate certain aspects of religion that I think don't get a lot of appreciation. In particular, I think religion helps people cope with the difficulties of life. And I don't think it offers theories that can compete with sciences if we're trying to understand nature. That job has been taken over by physics and biology and chemistry. I also don't think it's the crucial sort of force for morality in culture, because I think reason can figure out, you know, the golden rule and a variety of other moral, you know, obligations and duties and values. But I do think religion is uniquely suited to help people handle their emotions. And I was studying the emotions in animals, particularly in mammals, and there's a sort of a suite of specific emotions that we all seem to have, like lust, obviously, is something that we're born with, along with other mammals. We all have sort of emotions of play or joy. We have emotions of anger and fear. And also, there's a kind of emotion that we might call love, but in the animal kingdom, it looks more like bonding. So in this book, I'm trying to show how this handful of emotions is actually handled by religion. And so each of the chapters sort of looks at a specific emotion or a couple of emotions, and then tries to show how different rituals and beliefs help people deal with those emotions so that they adapt well to society. And I think that these things are actually, I think religion has actually evolved to help human beings to adapt and stay healthy and flourish.
To tie it back to music for a second, I was listening to an interview with someone who's a singer of choral music, and he described this experience, I think in England, of actually participating in a church service where there were probably 20 or 25 people at the service, and then later that evening singing some of the same music for a performance, a choral performance, where there were hundreds or even a couple of thousands of people who were really, really eager to hear this music in a concert form. And it seems like the kind of experience or emotional state of this music still has a hold on people, even when they're not, you know, belonging to the church per se. They want some of that experience.
Yeah. No, that's a great example. Like many people who are non-believers will go in and hear, you know, Bach's Mass in B minor or something in a church and be moved to tears. Why is that? It's incredibly beautiful, but also we have to think of that as a social ritual that people used not only for the intrinsic benefits and pleasures involved in art, but also this was a way in which groups bonded together through things like music and dance. And it showed, it was a way of creating solidarity, not just talking about it, but demonstrating it. So the way you do it is in collective kinds of activities that oftentimes foster positive affect or positive emotion. So this is oftentimes the kind of experience one has in church or temple or in the mosque. But also frequently, like if you lose a loved one, the funeral is arranged to create some new emotional experiences that can help the person who's grieving. And so religion oftentimes fosters these kinds of experiences.
Speaking of group bonding, there was something in your book where you described from driving from your home in Chicago to visit the Creation Museum in Petersburg, Kentucky, and you mentioned this kind of classic experience from driving across the United States, which is that different radio stations signal when you cross a cultural boundary. In the big cities, you might hear rap and rock that's more sort of ironic and cynical, and then out in the country, you hear much more kind of heartfelt and sincere country music. It seems like experiences like this help identify the listener, the performer, with belonging to a certain group, which you could even call kind of a tribe. Like there's the Blue America tribe and the Red America tribe. And you know when you're hearing rap or when you're hearing country, whether you belong to that group or not. I was just wondering whether understanding something about this sense of group belonging and the way culture and religion function to bind us to a group. Do you think there's any way that having a sense of that can help kind of communication across this divide between the kind of the country music red tribe and the rap music blue tribe in America?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good way to put it. And I did experience it as I went down to the Creation Museum. You know, that was just one of the things I noticed is that irony is very common, you know, in the sort of blue state tribe, you know, and sincerity is very common in the red state tribe. But many people have noticed that music has this ability to overcome some of these tribal differences. Even despite yourself, you might find yourself enjoying, you know, a song from a genre that your demographic group does not ordinarily listen to. And it might even be like a source of embarrassment for you, like, I'm not going to let my friends know that I'm listening to this, you know. But in fact, in your quiet moments on your own, you're connecting to that music. And so many people have noticed that music has this ability to rise above tribal differences. It seems to me that religion has also been playing this role. Now, I'm not naive. Religion is also one of the great forces of xenophobia and creating us-them divides where, okay, you're not in my club, you're in this other club. But I would say the vast majority of mainstream religious people are ecumenical. They're fairly open to difference. Of course, extremists in any of the religions, just like extremists in music taste, are going to browbeat their enemies and consider them to be, you know, uncivilized because they don't like the same stuff. But that's not the same as what I think the vast majority of people are using religion for. And I think this is also true in music. The major difference here, of course, is nobody's really usually killing each other over musical differences, and sometimes they are killing each other over religious differences. But people can be extremely, I think dogmatism is a style of thinking and believing that has to be, you know, moderated or reduced. So just like I think ideology in politics is really a problem. And I think orthodoxy in religion is the same kind of problem.
You describe in the book getting into a debate about Noah's Ark with Ken Ham, who runs the Creation Museum. I think it was about the dinosaurs fitting onto the Ark. And one of the points that you make is that trying to argue that a specific religious doctrine is false, like, say, the new atheists arguing that this can't be true, trying to argue the truth or falsity is unlikely to accomplish very much in terms of communicating or persuading people. Can you explain why that would be?
I'm not skeptical that, you know, we can convince or educate somebody with different views. We can, but you have to do it more carefully than we usually do. If I go to a student of mine who's very religious and I say, oh God, only, you know, idiots believe that dinosaurs were on Noah's Ark and you're a only clowns believe in Noah's Ark, you know, then what have I done? I've not only insulted the person, but also possibly their parents, their community, their loved ones who all take these ideas very seriously. Even if I don't agree with them, I have to find a better way to have the conversation with them. With a real dialogue, you can start showing, well, maybe there's some inconsistencies here. For example, I was talking with creationists, and they see one of their great enemies is Darwin, and they think Darwin and evolution, you know, we were never monkeys, they say, that's the great evil. But you talk to them a little longer and you begin to see that they're very worried about the earth being ancient, being, you know, billions of years old. They think it's around 6,000 years old. So pretty soon when you're talking to a creationist, you begin to show them actually you're in disagreement with all geology, too. And it's this kind of, you know, without sort of accusing them of being stupid or anything like this, you begin to show that there's evidence that's just stacking up. Yeah. And then some ideas or beliefs die the death of 1,000 qualifications, you know. Right. That you just, it, there's some kind of like pile up that occurs and the person can no longer sustain it. But it, I don't see it as my job to go around blasting people's beliefs to the ground. And it seems very counterintuitive, too. But I also believe that one should be engaging in dialogue. You can't just walk away from each other either and just throw your hands up. Well, you believe that, I believe this. You know, we've got to have these conversations.
In the book, you note that very few people really have a completely 100% scientific or rational foundation for all of their beliefs. And for example, many people, you talk about some students in the book, they might be against traditional religion and they say they don't believe in God, but at the same time, they're quite happy to believe in ghosts and reincarnation, and that, say, magical thinking can actually be found all over the place, not just among one particular group of people. And in order to explain why this is, you describe the so-called picture theory of the mind, the idea of kind of thinking in pictures. Can you talk about this picture theory and sort of what it means?
Yeah, it's. I was just thinking about modern art and things like, you know, abstract expressionism and painters that do things that are non-representational. And yet some of these paintings feel very harmonic, like they're pleasant to look at. Some of them are designed to be disturbing to look at. You know, you're supposed to have a sublime or irritating experience when you look at it. But sometimes you're looking at a painting and it's a blotch of red here and a blotch of black here and orange, and yet somehow the composition holds together really nice. There's a sort of a not well-known painter, you probably know this painter, Clifford Still. What I like about his paintings is they'll just be this huge swath of color and then just a little strip of red over here, you know. And I'm thinking in a way this is sort of like people's belief systems. They have beliefs that are oftentimes in relation to other beliefs. So nobody just holds the Book of Genesis story in a vacuum. They don't believe in Adam and Eve independent of all their other, the rest of their life. It's in the context of maybe their childhood, their grandmother taught them this on their knee. You know, I mean, there's a life history that our ideas are embedded in. And so I was thinking that the mind is more like a painting or a picture like this. And you pull on one thread or one piece of the composition, and you don't realize you're unsettling all these other images or shapes or colors. So it's almost like people's ideas are like a gestalt. You have to understand that, because if you start playing with one side of the gestalt, it basically relates to the rest of the thing. Now, that doesn't mean you can't do this, but it's up to us to realize that that's what's happening when we're challenging each other about these deep foundational beliefs. So I think it just helps guide the conversation better when we realize this.
We've been talking with Stephen Asma about his new book, Why We Need Religion, which is out in May from Oxford University Press. Stephen Asma's visit to UT Dallas was made possible by the Center for Values in Medicine, Science, and Technology. Athenaeum Review is produced by Creative Disturbance and the UT Dallas School of Arts and Humanities. Find out more at creativedisturbance.org.